You're listening to Better Than Fiction with your hosts, D.L. Nelson and Scott Sackett.
All right, welcome back to Better Than Fiction, your pop culture podcast. As always, I'm your host, D.L. Nelson, joined by my other host,
Scott Sackett.
And this will be episode 455.
Woo!
That's right, 455 episodes. Hey, it's been a minute since we recorded, but yeah. I think we've each...
Not literally, but yes.
I think we've each read a lot, probably watched a lot.
I've not read a lot.
Well, I've read a lot and watched a lot. So we're going to do some cool stuff. We're going to cover some stuff. But let's do this. There's a book that I read before I went to New York Comic Con, and I know you've read it too, and we haven't talked about it yet. And I thought we don't have to go deep on this book at all, but I actually liked it quite a bit. I know you didn't probably like it as much as me, and we'll get into that in a minute. But
You would probably be wrong.
Really?
I liked it a lot. You're talking about this book, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Well, explain what you told me earlier about it, your comment.
Oh, you must have misinterpreted what I said.
Okay. Well, the book in question is The Life and Art of Dave Cockrum, and it's a Tomorrow's book, and it's like a hardcover magazine-sized book, and the price on it's $27.95, and it's got 160 pages, and it's crammed full of very nice Dave Cockrum, mainly color art, but there's black and white art in here too. And we thought we'd talk a little bit about the book and maybe about Dave Cockrum's, what he was about and how important he was to... I can't really go deep on how important he was to Legion of Superheroes. I haven't really read much of that, but I can say how important he was to the X-Men.
Let me talk about this book first real quick, because you had texted me and asked me if I read it and if I could talk about it tonight, and I forget exactly what I said, but what I meant was I have skimmed this book. There's a lot of art in this book, but I think there's more text than art.
Well,
it goes in pretty much, and which is good because I knew very little about Dave Cockrum. I was not a Dave Cockrum fan growing up. I kind of started reading the X-Men after he had left. And when he came back, that was about the time I quit. I started to appreciate Dave Cockrum a lot more recently when I went back and read... a couple years ago, I went back and I had him, but I'd read the X-Men Essentials... So I went back to, what was it, 94 when they restarted the X-Men?
Yeah.
The X-Men Essential 1 starts off there. Dave Cockrum, I don't know what the difference is between his art there and when he came back to the X-Men. I think his art is a lot better on that first run. I think he had a different inker maybe. But there's some stuff on that first run when he with this, like, holy cow. And over the last, I'd say probably 5 or 10 years, my appreciation for artists that I didn't like when I was a kid, or I didn't care for when I was a kid, I should say, has I've learned to appreciate them for different things. And so there's some artists that I didn't like as a kid that I like now. Dave Cockrum definitely fits in that category. He's a really good artist, and I definitely appreciate him more than I ever did as a kid. You know.
So this book is broke up into 8 chapters, and they're all at different stages of his life. Like the first chapter is 43 to 70, and then it goes all the way. Chapter 8 is like 2003 to 2006, where he passed away. Now, at the end of each chapter, it's loaded with like end notes where the writer, which is Glenn Cadogan, cites where all this stuff, all this information comes from. And I found this book to be awesome. I mean, he really did a good job of not only reading a lot about Dave Cockrum, but also interviewing people, and really got down to kind of, I would say, what made Dave Cockrum tick. It's
very in depth.
It's in depth. Now, the text is a little bit big. Compared to some text, so meaning that, you know, if they would have went to the smaller font size or smaller size on it, they might have got more artwork in here or whatever. but it was easy to read, and the amount of art in it and examples.
Yeah, I mean, there's really a lot cool. of there's a the, you know I said there's a lot of text. There is a lot of art in this. Is a very good book. I would like to see. I mean, I have a lot of this kind of book of different artists. You know, where mm-hmm. kind of a I don't know if we call it a monograph or whatever. And this, it, just in terms of how it's put together and the material in there, this is probably one of the best.
Yeah, I think.
I think this is better than I have several of the Modern Masters books that Tomorrow's put out. I think this is better than
the. Well, Tomorrow, Matt, the Modern Masters, though, hang on.
They're magazines.
Number one, they're only 128 pages or right. less. Number two, they're usually, it's examples of the art, but it's also usually just an interview, just like an interview thing.
Right. Whereas and they talk is, about their career.
Yeah, yeah. This is
and this was done posthumously, so they couldn't do that.
Right. And it's also got just, I mean, I feel like in those interviews, they don't really get as deep as this gets. This was really
No good. Way. No yeah. way. Yeah, this is, I like this. This is... Well, you know, this is a biography of Dave Cockrum.
Right.
You know, it's not, it's put out by Tomorrow's, it's not put out by Simon & Schuster or whatever, but, I mean, it's, I don't know, how many pages is it? 160? 170?
Yeah, it's 160.
160. Yeah, if they'd have done it, if this would have came out through, you know, a book publisher... And been hardcover and had
been smaller
about 40 more pages
in small diameter,
a little bit smaller. Yeah, book size. This would have been just like a. I mean, it's got that much information in. I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I like it this size better. This was
no. This is great. I would want to change the thing.
This is a home run for me. I really enjoyed reading this book.
Yeah.
I was going to go over a couple things. I like I said, I read it before I went to New York, so. I had some notes on it. I misplaced them, but today I kind of skimmed through it, and I wanted to go over a few things. Like, early on, he was reading, like, his parents would get him these, like, funny animal comics.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, he liked them and all until he found a Captain Marvel comics. And he got into Captain Marvel, yeah. And that's what really got him going on the superhero thing. Now, a couple different times they moved. Now, parents, they moved a few times, and when they found his collection of comics, like, at one point his mom burned some of his comics.
I think so. Something happened. They were okay with the funny animal comics, but it seems like nothing else they were okay with.
Yeah, like his mom burned up his comic collection, maybe once or twice. He would also, as a youngster, he would write into various comic companies and get in their, like, their letter pages, and he... actually got into, like, I want to say his first comic he read was maybe, like, first Marvel was, like, Fantastic Four number 4, but he started writing into the letter pages so much so that that Stan Lee, when he joined the Navy eventually,
yeah,
Stan Lee, he wrote in from the Navy, and Stan Lee recognized his name, was like, oh, you're in the Navy now.
Yeah.
I mean, so he was really, really involved in comics early, early on. Comics fandom, which led to, and he was already drawing, that led to him doing illustrations for fanzines. And he kind of got a name because he was like one of the better artists in these fanzines.
Right.
And so by the time he gets out of the Navy, he signed up for 6 years in the Navy because he'd already done like 3 years of college. They gave him a better deal. Signed up for a little bit longer. He's making more money or whatever. Got out a little bit early. Didn't have to do the full 6 years. They let him out a little early. And he went straight to New York City, tried to get a job. Now he's like 26, I want to say.
Yeah, 26.
He goes to New York City. He goes to a couple different publishers. I think he started off at DC, if I'm not mistaken. They said, well, you're pretty good, but you're not like professional yet, level yet.
Yeah.
And he runs into Neil Adams. And Neil Adams actually knew who he was because he'd seen his art in fanzines. And said, yeah. Well, you're not good enough to work at Marvel either, but you should go to Warren Magazine and tell them I sent you. So he goes over there and puts in the Neil Adams sent me, and they actually gave him work, and so he...
Yeah, he said, go tell Jim Warren that I said to give you work.
Yeah, so he ends up working on some various, like, short story type of things in there, like 8-page stories and things like that, in Erie, Vampirella, I think was his first published work, and in, what's the other one they had? Creepy. And so he kind of got his foot in the door doing that. One thing I want to say is At one point, he was reading a Charlton comic called Son of Vulcan. He didn't like the guy's design, so he actually sent in his own design, and they liked his design so much they changed the character's costume based on his design.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where he got his flair, you might say. He started doing these costume designs and started creating characters. And that becomes very important later on. So after he's been at Warren for a while, doing creepy and eerie and Van Prilla stories, he happened to go to DC offices and just kind of hanging out, because now he's sort of on the professional level. And Julie Swartz comes out of the office and wanted to know who was out there who could maybe do a fill-in story. And he was the only guy available. He didn't really work for him, but Julie Swartz had already met him and said, okay, well, he'd give him a story. So that's how he got his first DC story.
Oh, yeah. This says he corresponded with Julie Schwartz while he was at...
He'd already been doing letters and stuff.
That fandom thing he had going.
Right. And then that kind of led him to get into... He got onto Legion of Superheroes, and he started... He redesigned some of the characters' costumes. They made them more up-to-date, because a lot of them had 50s costumes or whatever.
Yeah.
And this is only in the 70s, only 20 years later, but the costumes were a lot better, and the fans really took to that, and that's what kind of made him, I wouldn't say a household name, but it definitely made him a big name in the comics realm, which led to him going to eventually Marvel, redesigning or helping design or flat out creating some of the characters for the new X-Men. One of the characters he'd created years and years earlier, Nightcrawler, which was similar to the Nightcrawler in the X-Men, but a little bit different. But once he gets to Marvel, he brings his Nightcrawler character, and he makes a few changes to it. And that's like his favorite character design, basically.
Yeah.
And he basically gave it to Marvel. And so it's the Nightcrawler. And it's still pretty much the Nightcrawler that we know today. So anyways, that's just a little taste of how he got going. But this book is just full of, like, concept drawings and things like that he did along the way. It's a really cool book. I really recommend it.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that was in here that I thought made the book kind of cool was how much non-comic stuff was in. It would be like sketches he did of characters, for like a lot of costume designs. He was kind of known for having like a sketchbook full of just like costume designs he'd come up with. You know, like full color costume designs, and he was kind of I forget what book I was reading, but they were saying like, yeah, anytime they needed some characters, I can't remember if it must have been at Marvel, but they would kind of reach out to him because they knew he had kind of a flair for designing costumes. It was something he would just do, you know, but he also, apparently, there's some model kits that he designed in here.
Yeah, I didn't mention
kind of science fiction model kits. But there's all kinds of different illustrations he did that are not comics. They're kind of comics adjacent, but it's like spot illustrations, stuff like that.
Well, Alex Ross also wrote the introduction, and Alex Ross talks about kind of, and I haven't read it a bit, but from what I remember, how Dave Cockrum was kind of inspiration to him because of all the character designs and stuff that he did. Yeah. Also, one of the things I remember reading in here was he was so well known, I guess, as a letter writer, writing in about what was going on in the comics. He wrote in all the time. And so at one point, this girl writes him. Out of the blue, this girl writes him. And she disagreed with one of his comments.
Yeah.
And so she, you know, they used to print your whole name and address.
Yeah, they print your name and address.
You know, now they'll say, you know, it's okay for print, but back then they just kind of printed them or whatever. And so some girl just writes them out of the blue and says, hey, yeah, I disagree with it. And they got to write letters back and forth. And then she finds out, like, he's in the Navy or whatever. And he's out, was he in San Diego at the point? I don't remember. But anyway, she rides the bus out and meets him.
I can't remember where he was.
And then,
at.
like, I don't know if they were going to argue about their points or what, but she goes out there to meet him, and she wasn't very old. He didn't say how old she was, but he says she was not very old. And 10 days later, they eloped and went to Las Vegas and got married. Yeah. And that was his first wife.
I think that was his first wife, yeah.
But crazy times, man. But But yeah, this I think the book is sharp. I one thing I do like, it's got the, on these pages of concept drawings and stuff, he'll have like the front view of a character, the side view, maybe the back view of a character in here, and just kind of showing you like the different designs on the characters and different color concepts he's coming up with. Then there's covers for like the comic reader and just others, various, like here's a, do you have this, is this one of the books you've got?
I don't remember. I've got that book.
Yeah, this cover of this Marvel.
Novels.
Yeah.
This one was a, oh no, that's a reprint of Giant Size X-Men number one cover.
It's got some.
It was one of the novels.
Some roughs.
But it's of a painting
some,
he did.
There's some pencil roughs in here too of some covers.
Yeah.
Which this one here is pretty famous. It's the one where Magneto's trying to get Wolverine to use his claws on himself.
Yeah, you know, that's the interesting thing is that when John Byrne was even on the X-Men, a lot of the, John Byrne didn't do a lot of the covers for the X-Men issues he drew, and they would have Cockrum do it. The big thing about Cockrum, he was on the X-Men, but the X-Men were going to go monthly, and he, I don't know if he didn't think he'd keep up with the monthly book, or they could, there's kind of been some controversy about that.
But it didn't sound like he was pushed out. It seems, from the story, it seems almost like he wanted to go, he wanted to Byrne to be his following artist, but he didn't want to give up the covers because he felt like the covers were still important, so he didn't give up that control. He kept the covers. He didn't let Byrne do the covers for a while.
It's funny to think, when we think about John Byrne now, because, you know, but it's funny to think that at one point Marvel would not let him do covers. He didn't. A lot of the books he was on, he didn't do covers on.
It's funny to me too that you like John Byrne, such a well known icon, you might say, but really Dave Cockrum was the guy.
Yeah, Dave Cockrum was the guy, or even like on Iron Fist, you know, they might have like Gil Kane or George Perez or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is funny because, you know, yeah. John Byrne had a bigger career, I guess you might say. I don't know how you measure that exactly.
Well, I think you have to say he did because of Fantastic Four, and X-Men, Superman, everything else he did. Cochran only really, X-Men and Legion of Superheroes and various other small things, you know.
Right, yeah. But it's funny to think like, yeah, the first of his career, John Byrne, And there were a lot of people in the, John Byrne talked about, there were people in the office that didn't like his art, you know.
Well, I don't want to go any more in this book. If you're a fan of the Uncanny X-Men, after the Giant Size, then I think this book would be something that you would like.
It's the only thing I would add to what you said, sorry, don't think I would add before you move on is it talks about what he did, like, after the X-Men. And then it talks about some of the stuff that... I mean, it covers his entire career. But, I mean, he stayed pretty busy as long as he was able to work.
Yeah, he got sick, and it kind of limited his what he could do.
Yeah, I ended up in a VA hospital. And eventually passed away. Did he pass away from pneumonia? Or did he, it seemed like he had diabetes or something.
I think he did have diabetes, and I think he just had, I would have to read that again, but it seems like he just, he went on dialysis. I think his hands weren't working properly and things like that, if I'm not mistaken. And I think maybe he might have had something wrong with his vision, too. If you get all that going on, it's just too much.
So one of the things that in, towards the end of his life, when he was certainly so sick, is he was struggling for money, which is crazy to think about. This guy that had this, you know, career, so much that they did like a tribute book to try and raise money to help him with medical expenses and stuff. But Neil Adams kind of came to help him, and Neil Adams had one of the problems was Marvel Comics had instituted a royalty system. If you created a character, but it only was characters created after 79. The new X-Men was published in 1975, So, like, not even though he created Nightcrawler before the X-Men, on his own, Marvel owned it, and he didn't get a piece of anything with Nightcrawler. And so, and it said...
That was, it ended up being a loophole, though, didn't it?
Well, what happened is... let's see, in an online column, I'm trying to think who this guy is. It's Neil Adams and some lawyer named Meth, which is, and he was saying that Marvel told, the chief litigator for Marvel Comics said, we're not afraid of lawsuits. Everyone who sued us is lost. Even Stan Lee is suing us. And so, they were kind of going to hold they were going to be firm on it, but apparently they reached the deal in 2004 and it really was about Nightcrawler, according to this thing, that because that was the big thing. They even had, in fact, it said that Marvel had even published artwork in some of their books that said Dave Cockrum created this. It was like, here's a character Dave Cockrum created when he was in the Navy.
Yeah.
So they even, you know, kind of admitted. But apparently at some point, I think it said, like, Joe Quesada came and told him that they'd take care of him.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think it's, I'm looking for that. There's a lot of details here. Anyway, but yeah, so he was able, or, you know, at least, towards the end of his life, he got some financial compensation for some of his creations.
I don't know if it helped him a whole lot, but his wife was still alive for a while, and she was still able to get it too, I think.
Yeah.
I think they continued and went ahead and gave it to her after he died.
Yeah, he passed away in November 26, 2006. From complications from diabetes. He was 63 years old, which is not very old.
No, it's not very old.
You know.
When we're sitting here in our
the mid-50s.
Mid-50s, 63 is not very long.
Right. It's like, that. Well, I mean, Elvis is 69.
Wow, yeah.
You know, so think about that.
Yeah. All right, let's switch gears. Do you got something you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about something real quick. Or not real quick. So I'm going to ask you if you have these. So what I have in my hand is a black binder. It's about 3/4 inch, maybe 1/2 inch thick.
Yeah. Are those the X-Men cards?
Did you ever collect the X-Men cards?
How did I know they were X-Men cards? Before you even opened those up,
you know,
I said, are those the X-Men cards? Because I've got mine in a binder about like that.
Okay, and so what I have is in 92, Marvel Comics.
The Jim Lee ones, right?
They did the Jim Lee X-Men cards. Cards were kind of biggish, but...
No, they were huge back then.
They were, were these early or later in the card boom?
I don't remember where they really fell at.
Anyway, in the 90s, card booms got huge.
Yeah,
And I have, and I don't know how I do not remember buying any of these. I don't remember where I got them.
Well, you didn't have to buy the packs. You could actually buy those as a set, right?
I don't know.
Yeah.
They came in packs.
They did, but I think you could also buy them in a plastic box.
I did not buy a box.
I'm sure you didn't have, like, multiples of any of those, though.
I don't. No. This is what I have. I have...
No multiples.
I have the whole set.
Yeah.
I have the hologram cards.
Okay.
And I have the advanced hologram card. That's the only one I know where I got it.
What is it? I don't know what it is.
I think it's Magneto. Yes, the Magneto card, but on the back it says Advanced Comics.
All right.
And it is. And Mike Kennedy gave me that.
I may not have those.
Okay. There's only. I've only got one. But
yeah, I think I've got the 90 cards or 99 in the checklist.
I don't know where I can't remember where I got these. I've had them though.
But you didn't get them in a plastic box.
No.
But you see, you bought them in packs.
No. Maybe you think the box had all of them?
Yeah.
I think but it didn't have the holograms.
No, but you could go to,
You could go. I bought the holograms separately somewhere.
Maybe, but the
and the checklist. I have the checklist.
The checklist would have came with the set.
Yeah.
But here's the deal: there were so many card shops and people selling cards. I just bought mine as a set, like together.
Maybe that's what I did. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe you found a place and I said, I don't recall, and I have no idea how. And back in '92, I was pretty broke, so I know I didn't spend a lot of money on these. But it's like 100 cards. It's Jim Lee's interpretation of the X-Men. Jim Lee doing this was apparently was hugely influential on the X-Men cartoon.
Oh yeah.
They based a lot of their designs on this. I think these cards are really, really cool. I want to talk about them because I picked up this the other day.
I haven't seen that.
You haven't seen this?
No, but I know what it is, though.
Okay.
I've never seen one in person.
Okay. What I have in my hand is...
They do it for a lot of other sets, too.
Yeah, they do it for a lot of other sets. So I bought... Even though I have a set, I bought this. This is a book. It's put up by Abrams Comic Arts.
Does it have a card in it, too?
It has a set of cards in it.
Are they different?
I don't know. I haven't opened them.
Okay.
So this book... Don't open them. I haven't opened them
but
yet.
But, I mean, is that one of the cards you've got in your set?
I don't know. I'm going to look. I don't think it is.
You haven't looked over there yet?
I haven't compared them. Okay. We're going to compare them. This is the live unboxing. So, what this is this is a book, and it says, The Uncanny X-Men Trading Cards, a complete series, all cards illustrated by Jim Lee. The cover even kind of feels like the waxy packaging.
Oh, yeah.
And it's got... So, this book... has got a poster on the dust jacket. It's the
I've seen that before. That's
it's
cool.
The X-Men poster.
Yeah,
that's a you can get a T-shirt of that. I want the T-shirt with that on it.
Pretty snazzy.
It's pretty snazzy. It's Jim Lee. All this art is Jim Lee art. And this is a small book. It's like it's hardcover, size of an oversized paperback. The book now I just recently got this. It's been out since like August, I think. It covers $25. I saw it online and it was like $22, you know, and I was like, eh. I got this for like $13 this week.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, online it's cheap now. But initially it wasn't cheap. It's one of those and I resisted because I already had the cards, but I'm glad I bought this. The forward is by Ed Piskor. He helped put this together. They reviewed this on Cartoonist Kayfabe.
Oh, they did? I know this. Okay.
It's got pictures of the boxes that they came in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got Ed Piskor's talking about it. Pictures of the promotional posters. A piece of original art at actual size. So this is the size that Jim Lee drew them all at.
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously.
That's tiny.
It is tiny, but it's bigger. It is bigger than the cards.
Yeah.
And then it's got an introduction by Bob Budansky, who was the editor on these cards. And it tells the story of the cards. Actually, it tells the story of Marvel cards in the past, the Marvel stickers. I talked about that Marvel sticker book back in the day. In 76, they did the Marvel sticker set, which I had a bunch of when I was a kid. And then I bought that Marvel book that has the stickers in it, which is really cool. It's got different, you know, promote a spread of different stuff. Talks about just some of the Marvel card attempts. Then it's got a little history of the X-Men, you know, Wolverine. Talks about that. Talks about Jim Lee doing the X-Men relaunch in 91. And then it talks about the story of putting this thing together. When Jim Lee was doing this, the big thing was he still was penciling comics. He had to keep up with his comic output while he was doing this. But he said, yeah, you know, Jim Lee did it with no problem. You know, more original art. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of original art. There's kind of shows the process of doing it. It talks about in depth about how they put it together. And then talks about how hugely popular his card set was. Jim Lee was a huge artist at the time. The X-Men were huge. You know, it was one of those deals, you know, on Cartoonist Kayfabe. They said they felt like this card set was really something to kind of put Jim Lee over the top. You know, he's already working on X-Men, hard to say. So then it's got a reprint of the whole card set.
Yep.
And they're slightly bigger. I didn't realize this until I was looking at it this evening, but they're probably about 10% bigger, maybe, than the printed card. Goes through, it shows the back. One of the cool things about these cards that I think, and they're talking about on Cartoonist Kayfabe, the cards on the front, it had the illustration. On the back, it had like a headshot, talked about him, and it had kind of a little, like, here's one for Domino. It has a spot for the real name, the height, the weight, which group they're in, has their first appearance. And then it's got kind of a little power chart. Energy projection, mental power, strength, fighting ability, intelligence. And then it's got a little background thing, and it's got a little tribute thing about them.
You know, it would be cool if the card, front of the card was on the left and the back of the card was on the right, instead of putting the back of the card on the second page.
Ed Pisker talked about that. They asked him about that, and he told them, no, you got to do it like the thing is, where you flip it over and there's the thing.
I would have liked to see it side by side, personally. But I've already got the cards, so, you know. But.
Yeah. Anyway, and then under each one, there's a little comment from somebody. Usually it's Paul Mounts who colored them all, and he talks about how he did it.
I was going to ask if they're all colored by the same person.
Yeah, Paul Mounts. Jim Lee drew them and inked them, all of them. And then Paul Mounts colored them. Jubilee doesn't have any comments on it. That's a great Jubilee picture. Anyway, and then in the back, it has there's a what do you call it, where they put them all together, kind of a collage, a danger room collage. And it's got those cards, and then it's got the...
Has it got a picture of all the symbols?
I think it's got a picture of it all. Yeah, it's got... I thought it had one. Maybe it doesn't. And then it's got the holograms, which the holograms they had to photograph. So they look a little odd, but what's funny is you can actually see them better here than you can on the holograms.
Yeah.
There's the
I don't know if I've got those holograms or not. Maybe I do.
And then it's got the danger room. Those are all put together.
Like chase cards or something, maybe? I don't know.
The holograms or the danger room?
The danger room. That's called chase cards, or you try to build a picture, kind of like build a figure.
Maybe. I don't know. But anyway, it's a picture of the rapper.
Yeah. You know, they make those books of some Star Wars ones, I think.
I've seen some Star Wars ones. The other one I wanted to get, maybe the Mars
one, right?
There's a Planet of the Apes one. There's a Mars Attacks one.
Yeah.
That's the one that I've seen forever that I thought I should get that, but never have. So then included in here is some cards, and they're in a little thing.
I think they're different.
And I think they're different.
Because there's a beast on the cover there. That's a different beast, right?
Well, I think this says these limited edition bonus trading cards are produced exclusively by Abrams Comic Art.
Nice.
To accompany the Uncanny Trading Cards, a complete series which features all 105, which is the hologram, two collectible cards from the original set. Promotional use only, not for sale. This is called the Danger Room Test Sequence. Oh, that's the Danger Room one.
It's just like the whole thing in one photo.
Oh, this is, you know what? This is the cover of X-Men number one.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. So it's four cards all together, huh?
Yeah. Same thing on the back. Yep, so it's got four extra cards in here.
There you go.
Anyway.
Very nice.
Yeah, unfortunately, I only got a spot for three cards in my binder. But
if you need another clear page, I got one I'll give you.
No, do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're not going to use it. I don't know if you're collecting cards anymore. I don't know where you'd even get... I'm sure you could... I bet that place on MacArthur they'd probably sell them.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
But...
I'll see what I can do. I'll probably get a clear page I could give you.
If you have, that would be cool. But anyway, I kind of resisted... I saw this at the comic shop. It was cover price. And I thought about getting it. I thought, I got the cards.
Yeah.
And I do. You probably never look at yours. I look at these quite a bit, actually.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah. I like the art, man. You know.
Mine are in a binder. I know where my binder is. But
is it a single binder like this?
Maybe.
Or with other cards.
I've got a bunch of other cards, though. So there might be. I've got about four or five binders of cards.
Yeah, I got a couple binders of cards. Yeah, I dig the art, I dig the cards, I dig what, I like Jim Lee's art. But I think that I'm glad I got the book. I didn't know. You know, I kind of bought it. I mean, well, first off, I got a heck of a deal on it. It's like $10 off or whatever. I like the package. If you don't own the cards, you like Jim Lee's art, and you like X-Men, I'd highly recommend you pick this up.
Do those cards go for any money anymore?
I don't know. That's what I was wondering.
You get the book, do you need the cards anymore?
Well, if they don't, or if they do, I may sell my cards.
I think you got to keep those holographic ones. Those are kind of cool. I don't know if I've got the holographic ones or not.
Oh, yeah.
Or may or may not.
Yeah, that, to me, except for the holograms on eBay, you can get a set for $60.
Wow, that's expensive.
I don't think I paid, in fact, I'm pretty certain I didn't pay that much for it.
No, I think you might have paid 10.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously.
That seems more like my budget at that point.
Well, I mean, come on, it was the 90s.
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, $60 now. Yeah,
Some of these.
It's been 30 years, so why not, you know?
So here, someone wants $35 just for the Danger Room, the 9 Danger Room cards.
Wow.
Some of these cards do go for ridiculous prices.
Yeah. I mean, those cards individually or separate?
Yeah, individually. Somebody wants a Wolverine that's 9.5 and in a plastic thing. They want $110 for.
Whatever.
Yeah, I mean, buy the book.
Yeah, really. Unless you just have to have the cards. I think the book's good enough.
Well, the book. Oh, here, somebody wants $349 for their card. Oh, you don't. No. That's a whole box. A sealed box.
Yeah.
36 packs.
36 packs. What are there, like 8 in a pack or something? I don't think it's 10. It's probably 8.
Probably 8, yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. Not guaranteed you get a complete set, though.
No, probably will. But you could get... They did some signature cards.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could get a signature card, possibly. That's been dormant for... But anyway, I would say...
Jim Lee's signature's terrible, by the way.
He's got a couple...
He signed some of my books. His signature's terrible.
Oh, God. He signed that wizard book of mine.
It's like a J and a part of an L, and that's it.
Yeah, it's not like his art, is it?
No. His signature is, I mean, it is beyond terrible.
Yeah. Anyway, like I said, I picked this book up recently, and I, if you're in, I mean, you know, again, if you're like, I hate Jim Lee, or I hate the X-Men, or I hate Marvel Comics, this isn't for you.
You hate books.
Yeah, I hate books. I hate...
Why are you even listening to this podcast?
Yeah, go hang your head in shame. No. But if you were reading Jim Lee's X-Men back in the 90s, and you don't have the card set... And you always wanted the card set... Buy this. This is what you need.
I mean, if you're reading Jim Lee's X-Men in the 90s, how do you not have the card set? Because I just remember that was like a must, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, how do you do
that? Oh, yeah, because this is before he went left for Image, man.
Oh, yeah. How about if we switch gears? So,
okay.
I've had some free time on my hands.
Unless you have a book about trading cards you want to talk about.
No, I had some free time on my hands, though.
Oh, good.
And I watched three... classic movies.
Oh, cool.
That I hadn't seen before.
Okay.
And I was going to ask you if you've seen these movies. So, think back, 70s.
Okay.
Movies that probably you were too young to see in the theater, and me also, or even if we were the right age to see in the theater, we're probably seeing stuff like, you know, Star Wars or Close Encounters. But the first one I wanted to watch, I have never seen, and... For whatever reason, I decided I'm going to watch it. I watched Good Guys Wear Black. Have you watched this movie? Uh-oh, you're leaving the room. I need to pause this.
Have I watched Good Guys Wear Black? You could have came over to my house and borrowed the DVD.
Oh, darn, man. Good Guys Wear Black.
Dude, that movie's a great movie.
Yeah, so the other day I watched Good Guys Wear Black. All right, so... I see you've got a copy of Good Guys Wear Black. So, yes, I did watch Good Guys Wear Black. And
oh, you're gonna tell me you didn't like it now?
No, it.
Oh, dude, though, it's the perfect 70, late 70s. You know, I don't know if it's 70s or 80s, but that like era.
78 or 9, I think.
It's like, he's like, isn't he a ski instructor or something? Or
No. So in Good Guys Wear Black, he is a former, he was a former like commando in the military. And now, I don't remember exactly what he's doing now, but anyways, people in his platoon are getting killed, and then he's got this guy that was his commander, his boss or whatever. This guy's still floating around in the military, but he's more like, he's not a senator, but he's kind of on that level. He's like not on the field anymore. Like
he's
like wearing a suit.
Yeah,
and he's like maybe at the Pentagon, whatever, and. He contacts Chuck Norris's character, which, what is his character's name? Let's look his name up here. Booker, that's right. And he says, you know, people in our group, well, they went on this mission, and the mission was a setup. He gets there, and, like, they go to, back in the day, they go on this, like, his final mission. They find out there's some POWs or something behind the enemy lines. And his commando group is sent in, and this commander guy sends them in thinking it was a legit mission. When they get there, they find out that it's a complete trap. Like, there's no POWs in this base. It's just, like, there's really nobody there. And once they get in there, they're going to try to break out these POWs. They end up being surrounded, and all these, like, Viet Cong or whatever are picking them off. And, like Chuck Norris, maybe a couple more get away, but a lot of his group gets killed in this mission. And then they make it out toward the helicopters they're supposed to be, and the helicopters were turned away. Whoever set them up got rid of the helicopters. The helicopters never came to pick them up. So it took him a while to get out of there, going through the jungle or whatever, but him and a couple guys got out, and now it's, you know, 10, 15 years later, and they're all doing their own thing. And somebody starts killing those guys. And so he didn't know about it, because they all live different places. You know, this is pre-internet, pre-all this.
Right.
No one knows what's going on anywhere. And so this commander gets in touch with him and says, hey, you know, your team's getting killed, and I'm afraid they're going to try to kill you too. And I guess maybe like five guys might have survived, because a couple of them got killed. There's like still two left. And so Chuck Norris, Booker, he goes out to try to warn these guys that they're potentially going to get killed. And one guy gets killed, like a sniper gets him right when Chuck Norris meets up with him. The sniper's already going to kill this guy, and so he kills him. And then, I guess he didn't realize Chuck Norris's Booker's there or whatnot, and so it doesn't take a shot at him. But anyway, so it's basically him figuring out who set up their team and why, and trying to save the last couple of guys that you know from his commando unit or whatever. I thought it was okay, but you know, I didn't hate the movie, don't get me wrong. I mean,
yeah.
I always wanted to see, from when I was a kid, I always wanted to see
Good Kid. Oh, I remember seeing the commercials.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the commercials were everywhere.
And, you know, back then Chuck Norris was kind of the man, you know.
Yeah.
And this is pre-Walker, Texas Ranger. This is back when he was right out of, like, not that I saw him in the Bruce Lee movie.
Was it Game of Death he was in?
No. Wasn't the Game of Death. Right. Was it the Game of Death?
I thought it was Game of Death.
I thought it was the last one. I don't know if he was in that one. No, I think he was in the... I'll have to look that up. I don't think he's in the Game of Death. Anyway, I was really wanting Good Guys Wear Black to be, like, strictly martial arts and not this commando stuff. But I didn't know anything about it going in. I just always knew I wanted to watch it, so that I had a shot to watch it, and I watched it. And I guess the buildup of my mind of what it could be about and what it really was about was two different things. And it was almost more like a Rambo movie than it was.
Well, I wouldn't call it a Rambo
movie. Well, I mean, I'm not saying Rambo.
But it wasn't like a Bruce Lee movie.
I don't mean Rambo like, yeah, he goes to a small town and like something happens, they go after him, he goes up in the woods.
Right.
And they're going after him. But I mean, kind of like, it's like a former GI, you know, that's not a GI anymore, but he's been there, and I didn't really want to see that kind of movie. I mean, if I wanted to see that, I'd watch The Deer Hunter or watch whatever, you know, which The Deer Hunter is pretty awesome. But I just like, it was like, eh. Oh, and then I noticed on the box here, Jim Backus is in. You know Jim Backus is, right?
Yeah.
Thurston Howell III.
Thurston Howell, yeah.
And I remember he played like a doorman when they go to some place to meet somebody in a hotel or whatever, or an apartment complex or whatever. Somebody who knew what was going on, they go to meet this guy, and Thurston Howell III is like the doorman, and he's wearing like this captain's uniform as the doorman, and it's so off-putting. You're like, oh, there's Thurston Howell III dressed up like...
Yeah, but that's you. I mean, that doesn't...
It just took me right out of it. I'm like, oh my gosh. But I thought the movie was just kind of okay.
How did you see it?
Well, I'll tell you how I saw it. So, you ever go shop at Winco?
No.
Winco, at the very front of the... It's a big grocery store. The very front of it, it's got all these, like, Blu-rays and DVDs at, like, dirt cheap prices.
Oh, so you own it, too.
I do now.
Do you own a Blu-ray?
No.
Oh.
I mean, I got it for, like, well... My copy, though, has the next thing I'm going to talk about. Mine's a double billing of Good Guys Wear Black and A Force of One in the same package. So
I don't have that.
Well, you can borrow mine. So I also have a copy, and I bought it, like I said, dirt cheap. I think it was like $6 for both movies on DVD. It's got A Force of One. And I always wanted to see The Force of One also. Now, I don't know if you remember what the poster looks like, but it's like a triangle, and he's like set in Indian style inside this triangle.
Yeah, I don't remember anything about that.
And I'm like, what does that even mean? What is this? It's kind of into shadows. It's kind of like, you know. So I was like, what, you know. So I watched The Force of One.
Keep going. No, keep going.
Well, I watched The Force of One, and it's kind of a similar movie. But in The Force of One, I think he used to be like a military guy also. Now he's teaching karate or kung fu at his dojo. He's got all these kids. He's training all these kids and all this. But what happens in The Force of One is there's these undercover cops that are trying to bust this drug racket, right?
Yeah.
And these undercover cops notice this kid on a skateboard is selling drugs, and like, well, where's he taking the money? So these undercover cops are in this car, and they're kind of following this kid on the skateboard, and he takes the money into the sporting goods store, or he goes in the sporting goods store. Like, ah, the sporting goods store must be the front of where this kid's getting the drugs to sell, which I guess kind of makes sense. So at night, now here's what I think gets off the rails. At night, the cops go and they break into the sporting goods store. They're looking for, like, something that tells them the drugs are actually in the sporting goods store. Well, while they're in there, the two cops get murdered. Somebody kills these two cops while they're in the sporting goods store. And so then their bodies are, like, dumped in the river or whatever. And so later on, a couple more cops that are, like, drug, you know,
yeah,
part of the drug...
Yeah, the DEA or whatever. Yeah, it's like not the DEA, but
it's like the drug task force. Like, it's like San Francisco, maybe. A couple more cops get killed or whatever that are part of this drug task force. And they're realizing that whoever's killing these cops is crushing their windpipe or whatnot. And so they're like, well, who would have training to crush someone's windpipe? And how come these cops aren't shooting anybody? Their guns are not, they're holstered. And they're just getting, like, killed by, like, their throats or whatever. Then they're like, well, maybe it's some guy that's got martial arts background or military. And so this drug task force goes to Chuck Norris's dojo, and they're wanting to get trained by him because they're thinking they're up against some kind of karate guy or something.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And so a few of them get trained by Chuck Norris, but they're also going, well, Chuck Norris's character, and I don't recall what his name is, in the movie, but they kind of do some background on him. They go, oh, well, he was like Green Beret or whatever he was, and I teach karate. So they're kind of suspicious of him, like, well, maybe the guy that's teaching us this stuff as defense from it, maybe he's the guy doing it. And also, Chuck Norris's character is also still doing, like, these tough man contests. He'll go out and, like, fight other karate guys where people are, like, watching, like, people from his dojo going... that go to see him fight, like, and he'll train kind of MMA style, sort of. He'll train, then he'll go and fight, like, you know, once every 3 months or something. And so the cops are going, well, if it's not him doing it, it could be somebody in his circle of friends, because Chuck Norris's character knows all these guys that he's fighting against, because he knows them from the military or from other dojos or whatever. And so they're kind of suspicious, like, does he know who this guy is, or is he the guy? And so in the movie, there's this kid that he's taken under his wing, you might say. His kid's parents are dead, or his dad ran off, the mom died. So Chuck Norris kind of adopts this kid, and this kid kind of becomes his son. He calls him his son, and this kid's probably like in his maybe late teens, early 20s now. And this kid wants to fight like Chuck Norris, and Chuck Norris is like, well, you're not really ready yet and all this. But at one point, this kid, I forgot how he gets a little, he starts figuring out, like, he wants to figure out what's going on. So he starts kind of doing a little detective work himself, and he follows this car or something. He goes up in the hills, and he stakes out this house. This is the son doing this. And when he goes, he kind of climbs over the fence or goes around the back, and he's hide behind some bushes, and he sees, like, the guy that owns the sporting goods store, and, like, the guy that might own the house, and then one of the guys that he knows does karate are all having this meeting, and that's when he realizes, like, he sees them, like, they're all doing cocaine, and he's like, oh. And he's on it. You know, now he knows, like, oh, and this guy that my dad knows is in on it, and the sporting goods store owner's in on it, and they're doing the cocaine. So the kid's getting ready to leave, but he gets caught. And so the guy, this other martial arts guy that he knows, like, he knows the guy because it's his friend of his dad's, that guy kills him. And so he kills Chuck Norris's son. And so then, you know, now it's like, oh, man, not only did they kill, like, four cops, but, hey, by the way, whoever did it also killed your son. And he's like, and that's when Chuck Norris is like, he's taking out the trash. And
yeah, this is the final straw.
Yeah, and so I thought A Force of One was better than Good Guys Wear Black. I thought the story was better. I thought
it might be. I mean, sure.
They're very similar, sort of. His background's kind of the same, sort of, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I just like the story of A Force of One a little bit better than Good Guys Wear Black. But
I can see that.
They're both kind of in the same realm. I think they both come out like a year apart, you know, one of those kind of deals.
Was there a Fiat X19 in A Force of One?
Did he drive a small car? I think he did drive a small car in it, maybe.
Oh.
So, I don't know. I think he did drive that in maybe in the other movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, somebody did because of the Indy kicked him through the windshield, remember?
Yeah, like right here?
Yep.
Yeah. In that,
I think that's a Fiat X19, right?
I don't remember.
Or it's a different car.
Who's
it?
I don't remember.
Maybe he did drive.
I think he drove one. Maybe
he drove. No, yeah, he you're drove right.
One. No. In that one, in Good Guys Wear Black, he's a teacher, but he also, like, tries Porsches out on the Porsche test track, doesn't he?
That's right. Yeah, he drove like a C5 Porsche.
Yeah, something like that.
Or C3.
Yeah. But anyways, so I watched both those movies. I watched them both back-to-back the same day. I had a lot of time on my hands.
Apparently so.
I thought they're okay. But I'm going to tell you what the better movie was of the three, because I watched one more movie.
Okay, now, hang on. Let me just say this.
So I'm Chuck Norris' movie, though.
Oh, okay. Because I was looking...
What other Chuck Norris movie could it be?
I was looking, and my movies are mostly alphabetical, but some of them don't get put back in the right spot.
Yeah. What else
and there's be? The movie that I was looking for, which I think is a later movie in the Chuck Norris au revoir, is Invasion USA.
Haven't seen it.
It basically, America is invaded. It's like Rambo, or not Rambo, but
Red Dawn
yeah. With Chuck Norris.
Okay.
Yeah. It's.
Is it decent?
Yeah, it's decent. Yeah. I mean...
As decent as the movies can get, I guess.
As decent as Chuck Norris movies get.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not, you know...
I'm going to tell you the better... I watched one other movie from the same time period.
Okay.
And I thought it was better than those two. It's not a Chuck Norris movie. It's actually a Charles Bronson movie called Death Wish. Have you seen this?
I have it over there too, man. Oh, Death Wish is a classic.
Death Wish is really good. I had never seen it.
Oh, you hadn't?
And I know there's like five of them.
Well, I'd stop. The last few are like canon movies.
They're not even. No. Charles isn't in them.
He's in. Oh no, he's in them.
Oh, he is?
Okay. Yeah, I think he's in them. But I mean, Death Wish, and I don't know how soon the drop off is, but Death Wish is definitely the one you want to watch.
Yeah, Death Wish is pretty cool because he's like a, Charles Bronson's character is like an architect, and I think they're living in New York City, and I know they are, as a matter of fact, and his wife and daughter go to the grocery store, but as you know, if you go to the grocery store in New York City, if you don't bring that little cart with you, you can't take your groceries home, so the groceries end up in a box, and they put their name on it, and it's going to be delivered later on in the day.
Right.
So his wife and daughter go home. Well, these thug kind of kids, they see the wife and daughter, and they kind of see him as like rich people, sort of, and these thug kids are like...
Well, he's very well off, but they don't, he's an architect.
Well, they don't know that about him. They just realize the wife and daughter, they look like they've got money.
Well, I think where they live... Maybe.
Well, they saw the address.
They saw the address. It's a nice. It's like on the Upper East Side or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So these, and one of the kids is Jeff Goldblum.
Oh, yeah.
So and this is when Jeff Goldblum is probably like in his teens or maybe 22 or he's not very old. Probably early 20s.
I think he plays a punk kid in several movies. Yeah,
maybe.
It seems like, yeah.
But anyways, it's like him and about three other guys. They see the name on the box, the address. And later on in the day, they go up there and they knock. They get inside the building, they knock on the door, and they say, "Got your delivery." The daughter goes and answers it. She thinks it's the delivery, and it looks like a young guy. But they bust in and they throw the wife around, beat her up. They try to. I think they rape the daughter. They have their way with the daughter at least. They take her clothes off of her. They throw her around. You don't really see her get raped necessarily, but they really rough her up pretty good. The wife tries to...
It's pretty heavily implied.
It's very implied, yeah. The wife...
But it's not... I wouldn't consider... It's not really... Compared to some other movies...
It's not graphic, but it's implied that they raped the daughter. And at least you're like probably 85% sure it's what they did to her. And the mother tries to like put up a little fight. And at one point, one of the guys throw her down. She hits her head or something. Anyway, she ends up dying. The mom dies. The daughter gets... the daughter's able to crawl to the phone and call not only 911 back in those days, I guess. She calls, like, her husband because the daughter's married. The husband gets a hold of his father-in-law, Charles Bronson. They rush over to the hospital, and he finds out his wife's died and the daughter's really messed up. And anyways, it affects the daughter big time psychologically. Like, she doesn't want to be around her husband. She's has, like, a mental break. Because of what happened to her, they had to like put her in a. She can't stay home. They had to. The husband and her.
Yeah, doesn't she end up in an institution?
Yeah, the husband and her go away for a while to try to go to some sort of something or another, and he ends up having to put her in an institution. Charles Bronson's like, what are you doing to my daughter? And well, anyways, at one point, Charles Bronson, with his architecture firm. They send him to Arizona to help. Well, he's doing.
Oh, that's right.
He's doing something out there. With this guy's got a ranch out there in Arizona. He's doing a building or something out there. Well, as a thank you, the guy gives him like a box.
And doesn't he take him shooting?
He takes him shooting, and Charles Bronson never shot a gun, and all this blah blah blah. But to leave, he gives him to thank you for coming out and working on my project. He gives him this really nice box, and inside the box is like a chrome-plated, like a .45 or something, like a six-shooter. And so Charles Bronson's like, what am I going to do with this? But he takes it home. Well, now that his wife is murdered and his daughter's really messed up, what Charles Bronson decides to do, not that he's ever going to catch the guys that did it, but what he does is he decides to go out on his own, kind of like Batman, and take out the trash with bullets.
I don't
like the Punisher, actually.
I was going to say, I don't know what the... time frame is, but I feel like Death Wish probably influenced the Punisher.
Maybe. Like, he rides...
Because it's very similar.
He rides the subway at 2 a.m. waiting to get...
Yeah.
Waiting to get mugged.
He makes himself as a target.
He walks parks at night. He's down by the river at night walking around. Wherever he thinks there's going to be scum and villainy at, he's walking those streets waiting to get mugged, and then he just pulls a gun out and starts shooting people.
Yeah.
And he probably shoots six or seven people in the movie.
Something like that.
And the funny thing is, though, there's a detective. They're trying to figure out who's doing it. There's this detective. The detective surmises, like, well, it's probably somebody who's... And and it's kind of too convenient, really, but he's like, could it be somebody who has a loss in his, you know... Or,
well, yeah, they kind of...
Could it be somebody that's...
I think it's somebody that's mad at criminals.
Yeah, and do we know anybody that's got... And it's like, they narrow it down real quick that it could be him because of what's happened to him.
Right.
And then... But then they call him and they go, hey, if you're doing it, knock it off. So he leaves his gun.
Yeah, you kind of get this idea they don't really care that much.
Well, they don't, but they get him... He basically leaves his gun at work, so they won't... If they check his house, yeah. And so, at the end, they kind of have him, but they let him go because the people he's been killing are...
It's like, well, sorry, dudes.
Yeah. So, I actually enjoyed that more than the two Chuck Norris's movies.
Wasn't him and his wife, before the, you know, the grocery store thing, wasn't him and his wife, like, at a party, and he was kind of, like, wasn't he talking about, like, the current film, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I was thinking... Like, at the start of the movie, he was very much like, oh, criminals are just misunderstood, and seems like they were at a party or something, or am I misremembering
that? I don't remember that at all, but...
Okay, I may misremember that. Yeah. I was thinking at the start, it was implied that he was very much like, oh, criminals, you know, they're just misunderstood, and...
That sounds like the governor of New York, or the mayor of New York or something.
Yeah, maybe, but...
Yeah, I don't remember that, but, yeah, I mean... Those are three movies that I always kind of want to watch, and I never had really done it, and so I had some free time, and so I just knocked those out, and I was kind of a little bit disappointed about the subject matter of the two Chuck Norris movies, but I thought the Death Wish was pretty cool.
Yeah, I picked up Good Guys Wear Black when they went out of business.
Yeah.
All their DVDs were like half price.
Yeah.
And I spent like 3 hours up there one time, and I just went through every DVD, and it was probably like $6 new, or $6 used, and it's like, oh, yeah, I'll buy that for $3.
Yeah.
And I just left there with, you know,
just a stack. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, cause, and I was kind of like you. It was something I always wanted to watch, and I bought it, and I'd never seen it. And then one day my father-in-law was over here, and I was like, hey, how would you feel about watching a kung fu movie? And he's like, okay.
You know, what's funny is, you know, I've got a lot of movie channels I can pick from. You never see some of these movies like this ever up there to be watched.
Yeah, and you know, I know that this was your least favorite of them, was Good Guy, but it was a good movie.
It's not bad. No. It's just in my mind I had like... A completely different thing in my mind about what it's about.
Well, I think movies like this, because of, like, and I've thought about this in conjunction with James Bond, because of movies like The Bourne Identity, with what we see, how action movies are now is a lot different than it was back then. You know,
well,
there's
a
lot
action,
more.
Though. It's the
pacing.
It wasn't really that too much. It was more of just the whole... I really thought it was going to be like more of a karate movie.
Oh yeah, no.
I mean, look at the title, "Good Guys Wear Black." Look at what he's doing on the cover.
Yeah, it's the very last scene in the movie. He's kicking. He's got his sunglasses.
Yeah, it's a mirrored sunglasses of him or somebody going through the windshield kicking some guy driving the car.
You gotta love his mustache though.
His mustache. He's got it's on point.
Yeah.
You know, it's a solid mustache.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a mustache, you should. That's the kind of mustache you
want
to have.
If I ever grew a mustache, that's the mustache I want. The big, big bushy one, kind of droops around your mouth a little bit. Not a Fu Manchu though.
No. What he's got working there?
Just pat about bottom lip level.
Yeah. It's a good looking stash, man. Yeah. His stash game is high. It's tight, man. Yeah, I mean, it's probably my least favorite of the three by far, but they were all good. But I really wanted more. I was really expecting Chuck Norris to be more like a Bruce Lee movie, sort of.
Oh, yeah. Well...
And they're both more like, yeah, I'm a former GI.
Bruce Lee movie, you know, I mean, at the time that came out, there was a lot of... I mean, China was putting out a ton of, like, Shaw Brothers kung fu movies. But that stuff was kind of looked down upon here, sort of. So it still hadn't broken over, you know, into America, you know, until like Jet Li came along and some of that kind of stuff. You know, Jackie Chan. I mean, Bruce Lee kind of did, but it never, when he died, there was this gap, kind of.
All right, let's wrap this episode up right here. As always, I'm your host, Dale Nose, and joined by my other host,
Scott Sackett.
Come back next week for another all-new episode, and check out our blog at betterthanfixthepodcast.blogspot.com, where I will post some photos of not only the cool book we looked at, the cool cards Scott talked about, but also how about some screenshots of some cool movies
from maybe the 70s. Some Chuck Norris.
Some Chuck Norris, maybe some Charlie Bronson. Who knows?
And if you enjoy this podcast, please take a second to leave a review and subscribe. This will help other people find the podcast.
Yes, it will. And with that, we'll say, hey, see you next week. And we're out of here.